mitnehmen und erörtern, welche Rolle die EU im Vermindern von Ungleichheit spielt.
Thank you very much and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think in what I'm going to be saying, I'm going to be bringing together a few strands what we've been hearing so far this afternoon. In my opinion, the world is facing two really major urgencies, two really major crises, and that we're going to have to deal with them. The first is the climate crisis, and the second is the inequalities crisis. Now, quite a lot is already being done on the climate crisis, and rightly so, and we need to keep our attention on that. But not enough attention is being paid to the inequalities crisis. Despite the efforts of Oxfam, despite the efforts of Concord, despite the efforts of many of us, we're not doing enough. And that is partly because of its very systemic nature, part of what the ambassador was just talking about. But that's also why we in Concord are making such an effort to focus on the various different aspects of inequalities, because as we've been saying, they're not just economic inequalities, they're social, they're environmental, they're political, all types of inequalities coming together. And that also is symbolized by the very fact that in our globalized world, the systemic interconnected nature of everything and everyone means that all these issues are connected, actually. So it can seem really, really tough to deal with them. It is complex, but it's definitely not impossible. But we can look at many different angles. It can be migration, it can be the climate change, it can be social unrest. There are often either because of or linked to or causing inequalities. So there I'm completely in agreement with what Max has just been saying. SDG 10, which is our common UN goal, which is measuring progress on reducing inequalities, whether that's inequalities between people or inequalities between countries, SDG 10, like many other SDGs, it's not just off track. SDG 10 has gone backwards. Considerably backwards. And that actually has stemmed from, Max mentioned it, 2020. But it's partly, at least, because of the COVID crisis. And what happened after the COVID crisis and the response to the COVID crisis, but also then the war in Ukraine and Russia's invasion of Ukraine and that huge inflation surge that's happened thereafter. But what happened with COVID didn't just affect us badly. It actually hit the furthest behind hardest. And when I say COVID, I don't mean the pandemic per se. I mean all the impacts of the pandemic. So particularly the economic aspects, for example, of the pandemic. So this hit those people without safety nets. The people who already lived on the edge of precarity. The people who didn't think it could get much worse, they were hit the hardest. But as we've been hearing already, who actually benefited even, I would say. I wouldn't just say that their wealth increased, I would say they even benefited. Billionaires. And especially those top 5 to 10 billionaires. Surely we need to ask ourselves some really tough questions. How can we, whether as individuals or as politicians or as even corporates, how can we accept that? How can we tolerate it? I'd like us to be really clear about one thing. Inequalities aren't accidents of fate. Inequalities are the results of deliberate choices made by people in positions of power. Those people may be in government, they may be in international institutions, and they may be in multinational corporations. Their decisions, their actions, are what have caused inequalities. People have been left behind because leaders chose to focus on economic growth, on profit, and on the accumulation of wealth. people have been left behind because governments and CEOs decided that a small state was actually better. Let the so-called market do its job. Let's privatize everything. So tax became a dirty word, especially if it was going to be applied to corporates. Social protection systems got affected, dismantled in some instances. Regulation became about creating an enabling environment for business, not about making sure that people had decent jobs, that workers' rights was respected, or that the environment was protected. People got left behind because money and financial capital got worshipped, not human capital, or people, as we would say. Everything got monetized except what really counts: care, solidarity, the environment. They have no monetary value, so they aren't valued. Imagine what would happen if we priced into the cost of production all the harm that's being done to the environment, to the biodiversity, to our planet, all the water that's being used up in the mountain villages. Political leaders, egged on by corporate CEOs, would never have been able to develop this system of consumption and production on steroids as they did if we had really and truly costed all the harm that's being done. This system is what we've been discussing today. This is called neoliberal capitalism. This system is based on needing, in inverted commas, constant economic growth and being measured by one figure, admittedly a composite, but nonetheless one figure, GDP, or gross domestic product. This mantra whereby GDP has to keep growing means that, of course, companies have to keep producing. They have to increase production all the time of goods and services. And then, of course, they have to force us to keep consuming it because they have to sell it. So economic growth isn't about making sure that everyone in society has what they need for well-being. No. It's about creating a desire to own more stuff. So the real truth about billionaires is not that they create wealth. They extract wealth. They extract it by exploiting people and the planet. And the private sector doesn't care that our planet is finite, and that infinite growth on a finite planet just is not possible. The only goal is profit, and creating, as Max just mentioned, shareholder value. That's all that matters. And this is what underpins inequalities. This and the total loss of control over the economy. Now, if these soaring inequalities that we're seeing are the direct result of choices and actions, or non-actions, by people, then in principle, these policies and actions could be reversed, and we can solve the problem. But it's going to depend on political will. Where there's a will, there's a way. So I agree, there is hope. In principle. But unfortunately, in the EU context at least, and that's the context that I know better, I'm not so hopeful. And I was invited here because I come from the Brussels bubble, as we call it, and so I understand what's going on a little bit, at least in the EU context, with the EU institutions. And so that's what I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about. What's happening in the EU is also what's happening in member states, like Austria. And the links between the member states and the EU are getting closer and closer. So what happens in the EU, we're now seeing happening in member states. It's not just a one-way thing. It's together, working together. So there's a lot of alignment going on. Now, it seems when you speak to policymakers that they are trying to take a long-term perspective on things. But in fact, from my perspective at least, it seems to me that they're reacting very much to the uncertainty and the insecurity in the world. And there's plenty of it at the moment. But the problem is with insecurity and uncertainty, we tend to have a bit of panic mode, and actually we end up with short-termism, short-term decisions. And I think that might be a trap that policymakers at the moment are falling into. I had a conversation recently with the Director General of the European Commission Directorate called International Partnerships. So it's the one that deals with development cooperation. And what he said to me is, Tanya, development cooperation as we know it isn't working. Quote, it isn't working. Now, I don't know exactly on what grounds he made that claim. I mean, he did go on to justify it up to a point, but I didn't really quite agree, I must admit. But we have seen improvements, thanks to the work of many of us in the room of governments working on international cooperation. We have seen improvements in social and economic rights, for example, of people around the world. But this statement signaled a massive change in direction by the EU. I mean, seismic changes are going on right now. What we're seeing is that we're aligning, all of the EU top officials are aligning behind a new way forward. We're putting all our international cooperation eggs in one basket, if you like. And this basket is called the Global Gateway. You may have heard of it. It's all about big investment projects in infrastructure, connectivity, energy. For me, who's been around a while, I'm sorry, I am a bit of a dinosaur here, but I feel like we're going back to the 1980s and the 1990s with these big investment projects. And in those days, we stopped doing that because it was shown that they weren't working. And that's why we moved on to focus much more on human development. Well, that's not working either, apparently. So why would we just go back and do what we did about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago? I don't get it. But anyhow, this is what's happening now. The president of the European Commission has been extremely clear in the guidance that she set out. She published it in June, and she's been informing all the commissioners that are going to come on board that the way forward, it's so dangerous, it's so littered with threats and insecurity of all kinds, that we have to focus on making the EU competitive. Whatever we do, that has to be our number one thing. We must compete with China, except we don't mention China anymore. But actually, we must beat China. And all the commissioners who are coming in must work towards that one goal of making the EU competitive, even the commissioner who's responsible for international partnerships. Now, the Global Gateway actually isn't new now. It was developed already at the end of 2021. And it was the EU's answer to the China's Belt and Road project. It was supposed to be the EU's values-based offer. In actual fact, now the EU is very genuinely being a lot more honest about things. And it is saying that, no, the Global Gateway is about securing the EU's economic interests. It is about securing our supplies of critical raw materials, our energy supplies, in order to make us safe. Europe first. So development cooperation is now going to be predominantly used to promote the EU's economic interests and economic security. And we're told that that's totally in line with what partner countries want. Now, quite apart from the fact that I'm actually a little bit sceptical the degree to which Global Gateway has been truly discussed with partner countries and how much room for manoeuvre they truly had to influence decisions that were being made, One of my big concerns is about how these projects are going to be financed, these big investment infrastructure style projects, how they're going to be financed, because it's going to be using loans. So ODA, Official Development Assistance, is going to be used to give loans, and we all know that loans need to be paid back. I'm sure many of us have loans in this room. They have to be paid back. So loans are going to increase countries' debt levels. Whether the project was a success or not, whether it improved people's lives or not. Now, half the countries in Africa are already in or at high risk of debt distress. And we heard it earlier on, I think Karin was already referring to it, payments on debt servicing are one of the main reasons why countries can't invest in quality services for their own populations, they can't invest in their own infrastructure, and they can't invest in their own industry. In fact, partner countries' debt servicing payments, if you put them together with illicit financial flows that we were talking about earlier, mean that more money flows to the global north, the minority world, than flows to the global south. So the global south is subsidizing the global north. I think that's something else we should ponder on. Anyhow, we've been doing a bit of work in Concord, a bit of research, on whether things like global gateway projects actually could reduce inequalities, because let's face it, that's what we're here to talk about today. Our findings weren't very, very surprising, to be honest. They could, in principle, actually support inequality, reducing inequalities, but you have to design the project with that aim in mind. And that's not happening. Not at the moment, anyway. Global Gateway is about encouraging and supporting European private sector to invest in partner countries. Now, I'm not against the private sector. I may sound as though I am, but I'm not. We need the private sector. We need the private sector to achieve the SDGs. But the private sector's motive is profit, not putting the furthest behind first. May I just end with another piece of work that we've been doing? We produce a report called AidWatch, and AidWatch looks at member states' ODA, so official development assistance. And what we decided to do was to compare the amounts of ODA going to partner countries versus their status on the Human Development Index. It's not a perfect exercise, but it was very clear that more money, more ODA money, was going to countries that are higher on the Human Development Index, so they didn't need so much money. More money was going to them than the ones very low on the Human Development Index that needed much more support. So there's already this skewing of EU ODA from the very start. So maybe I can conclude with just a few thoughts, a few ideas. I think civil society has been doing a lot already. We heard what Oxfam has been doing, what Concord's been doing, what researchers are doing to sort of spearhead awareness raising around the problem of inequalities. We've been talking about beyond growth and these kinds of conversations. We're trying to make sure that marginalized and excluded communities can have their say and bring their points to policymakers themselves. But we can't, by ourselves, change the structural and the systemic thing, you know, the system, not by ourselves. We need other people on board. So we've really got to work together and bring our creative juices, all of us together, to policymakers and to corporates to actually start changing the system. Because that's actually the only way we're going to sort out inequalities, is changing the system and how the system operates. And yes, we can do it bit by bit. It's not going to be done in, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. But we've got to start, and we've got to have that willpower, and we've got to convince the policymakers to be behind us on this one so that they do take control of the economy, because that's what we need. So that the economy serves people and the planet, not the other way around. Thank you very much.
Vielen Dank, Frau Cox. Ich könnte mir vorstellen, dass es jetzt wieder viele Fragen, Anregungen, vielleicht auch Widerspruch gibt. Bitte merken Sie sich all diese Ideen. Ich darf Sie jetzt einladen, da hinten von mir aus gesehen rechts, von Ihnen gesehen aus links, einen Kaffee, Apfelstrudel, Topfenstrudel, Glas Wasser einzunehmen. Und in 30 Minuten wird es hier wieder weitergehen. Das wird dann 5 nach 18 Uhr sein.